you're on the front porch where we tackle the tough issues facing West Virginia and Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. In the Southern District Federal Court of West Virginia, the last time a heroin case went to trial is 2014. Is that too long? Are we plea bargaining too many things out, or do we need more trials? A dispute has erupted here in West Virginia. We'll talk about it with our own lawyer, Lori Lynn. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And he doesn't have a law degree, but he might as well have. He plays one on TV. Rick Wilson. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And with your super dog, Bo, and then Bo's friend. Introduce her, please.
That would be Edith. She's sort of, they're not related. She's like a cougar and Bo is the cub.
So we're a dog-friendly workplace, as we've already established from a previous front porch. So welcome to everybody. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Obamacare repeal. It's been on again, off again, and now apparently on again. And the big question of today is WWCD, what will Capito do? And finally, why doesn't Pluto wear pants? The Front Porch is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, download the CGM app at iTunes or Google Play. A federal judge, Judge Joe Bob Goodwin, he issued a decision that was controversial, and it was taking prosecutors and defense lawyers to task for having too many plea bargains.
Judge Goodwin used this to say, look, I think we need to be having more trials. Trials serve a useful purpose in our community. It shows we're prosecuting these crimes and taking them seriously versus what he referred to the plea bargain system as more of like, you know, happening in the dark. Judge Goodwin is arguing that there's a benefit to the public kind of spectacle of a trial.
I mean, I read the judge's opinion on the, what's the technical term?
It's an opinion. It accompanied an order. It wasn't, right, you know, really a decision, but yeah, it's an opinion. It was a long opinion, 20 pages, very detailed, including graphs. He really went to a lot of trouble with it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he thought about it a while. I think obviously the opioid epidemic has been, you know, troubling him, and he really felt like he had to make a statement about it. But it's interesting, toward the end of it, as I recall, he said that prohibition isn't working and that the general practice so far that's been the norm for the last couple of decades wasn't working. So I think clearly he feels conflicted about it.
I mean, it's almost like he's saying it's gotten too easy to plea bargain these cases out. No one's paying attention anymore to it. And therefore, we're not really dealing with the underlying issues here. Lori, what got your attention about this?
Well, it's interesting. I keep thinking of, in his opinion, he says there's only been 18 criminal cases in the Southern District here since January 2013. 18 criminal cases, that's not, obviously the courts are doing civil cases. There's a whole different side. It's not like there's nothing going on, but that's not a lot of criminal cases. One of those cases was a very public one that we all know about. That was the Don Blankenship trial. And in that case, I think a lot of people, including people on the left, would recognize that there was a value in having Don Blankenship be tried in front of a jury, having, you know, the allegations against him related to the mine explosion, you know, really hashed through. It was a very, very public thing. Why don't we have the same instinctive reaction when it's someone who, for example, has distributed fentanyl, which, you know, kills people? I think it should be kind of the same thing, right? Don't we want it brought to light? Don't we want people to see someone getting questioned and going before a jury and, you know, ultimately getting justice, however it comes out? So I think it's interesting to kind of put those two things side by side and see what our different reactions are to them.
Although I'd have to say in the Upper Big Branch case, we're talking about the deaths of 29 coal miners, you know, after a pattern of what some people would say is an effort to get around safety rules and regulations. So, you know, and also the sheer rarity of any CEO of a major corporation being held accountable for anything. I mean, that's like a extreme outlier. Doesn't happen very often.
Well, and I guess that's the crux of the issue, which is, why do we do plea bargains? We do plea bargains because it's a way of getting justice more efficiently. If everybody went through a full trial, the whole system would jam up. So it's interesting to see someone in the system, in this case, a federal judge, say the system is not working. And it's not working because we are being too efficient. We're being too cavalier and having too many of these plea bargains. And then to have the defense lawyers then come out and do a joint op-ed saying, no, the system is best for our clients and it's a bad idea to be wanting to have more of these trials.
Well, the other thing, like a lot of these trials take place in circuit courts, don't they? They don't always take place in federal courts. So I think
there's an awful lot
of drug prosecutions that are going on. Secondly, I do think that the public defenders have a point that when it goes to trial, typically the sentence is longer. And they also point out, just the general cost of mass incarceration. So I think they have some good points here.
Yeah. I mean, the point that Rick just made, this is federal court, right? Judge Goodwin is a federal judge. And so there are plenty of drug prosecutions going on in the state courts, although there are plea bargains there, too, as well. And I don't have the stats, but I imagine they plea plenty of their criminal cases out there. I mean, the one stat I do think you can't get around is that 97.1% of federal criminal convictions are through plea bargains. So very, very, very few trials. And that used to be down around 50%. It's just gone up and up and up over the decades. So there certainly has been a change.
Yeah, and as I understand what the public defenders are saying, they're not saying, yay, let's just have plea bargains all the time. They're pointing out that, this trend toward mass incarceration hasn't really brought down the overdose rates. And, you know, they cite a Pew study where they've looked at many states, and they found no statistically significant relationship between the state's drug offender and prison rates and three measures of drug problems, rates of illicit use, overdoses, and arrests.
It's really not in very many people's interest to have more criminal jury trials. It's a huge hassle for everyone at the courthouse, essentially for the public defender, for the prosecutor, for the judges, to be honest, for the jury. It's a huge use of resources. So I don't see it changing a whole lot. I do think it's worth asking, why do we have so many more federal prosecutors and so many fewer trials? What are they doing? Obviously, they have civil dockets as well. But I think this is a really interesting opinion. I think it brings a lot of things to light, but I don't see a whole lot changing because of it.
Well, sometimes these things change over time. I go back to when I used to cover the crack cocaine cases and listen to Judge Goodwin talk about how he's issuing this decision, but he feels this is a bad sentence, and explain to everybody why, including the defendants. And when that happens enough, eventually what happened is they changed the sentencing guidelines.
Right. He was critical of the mandatory minimum.
Yeah,
right?
Very critical of that. So this is not a law and order, throw the book at him sort of guy. I think what he's trying to say is we're not being thoughtful enough in the process. It's very rare to have a judge do that, by the way. I mean, usually judges are very focused on just what's their job in this case. And here's a judge who, by the way, has a political background. And in stepping up above that and looking down at the whole system and saying, the system, this is not working for the system.
Judge Goodwin, it's interesting to note, has been off of criminal trials for the past several years because his son, Booth Goodwin, was the United States attorney here in the Southern District. So for several years, as long as Booth Goodwin was in that role, Judge Goodwin had to recuse himself from anything involving that office. Of course, all criminal trials involve that office. So his docket was purely civil. So he's kind of getting back into the criminal side now and maybe kind of going, whoa, I don't like what I see. Things have changed a little bit.
All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the latest on the Obamacare repeal and Shelley Moore Capito's role in that. And then I want to talk a little bit about animals in animation and whether they talk or not. And what does that say about our ideas about who is human? But first, I have a question for you guys about maintaining friendships. We have just concluded a really successful Protect WVPB campaign where we wanted to raise $500,000. We raised $600,000. So you all helped us get that far and farther. And we gained an additional 1,500 members that we didn't have before.
It was sheer terror at losing access to the front porch that probably put you over the top.
You know, right? I got to say, we did a member survey and the front porch spontaneously popped up in 3 or 4 of the comments. So
3 or 4, wow.
Out of 1,200.
Okay, but, next subject, all right.
You know, my mom was busy.
Mine's dead.
But how do we make sure that they feel appreciated and that we keep people, happy? Do you have any ideas?
Well, giving them shout outs like we're doing right now is one great thing.
This is so meta.
Reading reader comments on the air, that kind of engagement.
You're really on it with Facebook, too. I mean, you really respond to comments.
Yeah, that's another really nice way. People feel like they're part of the conversation. They can kind of easily slip into that.
And maybe a live event. We've threatened to have a live
A
live front porch event before.
An actual front porch.
A front porch on the front porch. I'm waiting now for summer to get over.
Yeah, it's too hot right now. Yeah.
But maybe in the fall. Meanwhile, thank you if you are a member. And if you're not yet, it's so easy to make it right. Go to wvpublic.org, click the donate button, and tell them you're doing it because of Lori, Rick, and the front porch. Thanks. We're going to discuss just briefly the latest with the Obamacare repeal. And of course, related to that, President Trump's visit to the Boy Scout Jamboree here in West Virginia. So let's just start with the fun stuff. The speech is just, it is crack cocaine for a political junkie because it was fascinating.
Yeah, well, as a former scout, it was kind of jarring. Well, scouts are supposed to be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. And not all of those notes were hit during the speech. Let me just say that.
What do you make of the reaction of the crowd, the 40,000 boys that were there? It is unambiguous. They were enthusiastic. They were responding when he wanted them to respond. Lori, what's your take on that?
Well, I think scouting and where these boys were probably coming from, probably most of them were from red state-ish backgrounds. So I'm not terribly surprised by their reaction. I think the reaction of the media and, you know, the intelligentsia and it seemed to me a little bit overheated. I mean, if you took your kid to the resistance rally and put her in a pink vagina hat and posted pictures of, I kind of don't want to hear about the politicization of children.
Whereas the scout thing is,
yeah, sure. But you know, this idea that, like, oh, we can't, you know, we have to shield the precious children from any sort of politics. I mean, you know, I agree. It's distasteful. A lot of what the president says is distasteful, regardless of, you know, the forum in which he says it. So I found it a little bit overblown, but, you know, also terrible. So as is my reaction to a lot of this president.
Well, you know, one reason why, like, say Obama didn't go was in part in person. He did like a video thing one time is because of the scout's policy at the time towards people who are gay, which has since changed.
That's a whole separate debate about the scouts and everything. But we're talking about it because it's here in West Virginia. And also, President Trump used it as an opportunity to put the spotlight on Senator Shelley Marcapito. He mentioned her in the speech. He put her on the spot. And then she voted to proceed with the debate on repealing Obamacare. You know, by the time you listen to this, maybe there's been a vote and a decision made on this already. What do you make of what's happening, Lori, and where Shelley Marcapito might go next?
Well, this is what I will say about whatever her final decision is. She is not going to be the one vote that sinks this repeal effort, right?
Because she could have been.
She said she was willing to before.
Well, but yeah, she had a chance. She could have said, I don't want to debate this. And that may have been the death of it. Oh, maybe not. I don't know. But you're right. She proved she didn't want to be the person that does it.
And she won't be. It will either be they come up with some sort of compromise, which will probably involve throwing more money at the Medicaid situation. And then that will get her on board. It will get Portman on board, Alexander, a few other people. I mean, there's six or seven people who are kind of in that group. If the six go along, she is not going to be the holdout guy. It's inconceivable that a Republican senator from the state that had the highest margin of victory for Donald Trump is going to be the one Republican senator who kills the repeal effort. I think it's more likely that she will be part of a group that, you know, eventually votes no, and that will, you know, insulate her politically because she will not have killed it herself. It's just she is not the type of senator, the kind of maverick Ron Paul, John McCain, who is going to take that kind of a stand and attract that kind of national, you know, love on one side, the wrong side for her, and hatred on her own side. That's inconceivable to me.
I just think the contrast between the courage expressed a week or so ago and where we are now is kind of striking. And I would be, I'm trying to be charitable here and, you know, invoke the better angels of my nature, but there's an article in The Onion that was kind of interesting, if you've seen it. The headline goes, Senator struggling to weigh interests of entire constituency against nothing. Anyway, I don't know where it's going to wind up. I was obviously disappointed by this. I think she does have a critical role in this, and it'll be a defining moment for which she'll be remembered. We're also coming up on the 52nd birthday of Medicaid on July 30th, which her father, Archmore, voted for when he was a Republican representative in Congress. So that's just an interesting confluence of events.
You know, I've been a follower of Shelley Mercapito's political career since the beginning. And she wants to brand herself not as ideological extremist. She wants to be someone who gets things done. And if she is the person that brings this thing down, that the Republicans, her base and the Republican leadership really wants to get done, what does that do her to her ability to get anything else done? All these other issues that she feels passionately about.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the problem that she has. In some ways, her temperament, which I think is a great temperament for the Senate, but it's the temperament of a senator from Delaware or Wisconsin. It's an awkward fit for her base here in West Virginia, which is very much Republican. And, you know, again, they voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, who was not coy about his goal of repealing Obamacare. So that is the problem that she has. And I don't envy her. I don't think anyone in the Senate envies her.
Let's see, Bo is clearly getting exercise.
Yeah, they're
this.
Really it's into big. This whole Obamacare yeah. thing.
The opportunity for actual bipartisan problem solving would have been like an interesting thing and probably really useful here. And that's the road not taken. Again, I don't think they even know what they're going to be voting on.
So the latest is skinny repeal, which is basically a very stripped down version of a repeal bill. And at that point, it goes to a conference committee. And one school of thought is that this is like a hot potato. Obamacare repeal is a hot potato. The House had trouble with it, and they tossed it over to the Senate. A bill that some people on the way over said, well, I voted for this thing, but, you know, I'm hoping the Senate changes it. And now the Senate has the hot potato, and I think that they might do the same thing. They might take it and say, oh, you know, we'll pass a skinny repeal, knowing that this isn't the final version, and pass it over to a conference committee of the House and the Senate. And at the end of the day, that would come back to both chambers, and they'd have to make some sort of decision on, is this good enough for us or not? And that'll be the real day of reckoning. I think it's so hard and so painful that the Republicans keep putting it off. Capitol doesn't want to be the person that kills it. The Senate doesn't want to be the entity that kills it. No one wants to be responsible for this not happening, and yet they still haven't figured out how to make the repeal happen.
I mean, the bottom line is this is going to affect the lives of millions of people now and to come, especially if they push through caps and cuts to Medicaid, which is like lifetime limits imposed on a whole state, and also shift the cost to states. I mean, that could have a really disastrous impact, not just on, you know, health and things like that, but you saw CAMC yesterday laying off people. I mean, if there's going to be a massive ramping down and loss of coverage for people, that's going to be the first of it. And more people work in healthcare than they do in coal mines.
All right. Well, you know, let's switch to something a little bit less contentious, which goes along with your dogs here, Bo and Edith.
I don't know what that little upsurge was about there.
Now they're back asleep.
Oh, they're calm.
I think
again.
They liked Lori's voice.
Well, this came up in my family the other day, and I'm actually half serious about it. I know this is like high nerd, this conversation, but it does go to something important, which I'll get to. How is it that animals in animation, they are all over the place about their humanness? And actually, the most bizarre is some of the oldest ones, like Mickey Mouse in the Mickey Mouse universe. The difference between Pluto and Goofy.
Yeah.
Right? Pluto is a pet. Goofy is a person. Goofy wears clothing, at least some clothing, maybe not enough. Pluto wears none. Goofy talks, Pluto does not. Pluto is owned by a mouse, which is larger than Pluto, which also is weird, right?
Could that symbolize like the large working class ruled over by a tiny oligarchy? Is that like the hidden subtext of this?
I think you've hit on it, Rick.
Well, I'm just curious. Like at some point, Walt Disney or somebody had to decide that there were dogs that talked and walked and dogs that were owned. Is this a slavery analogy? Could Pluto, you know, learn how to talk and walk upright and buy his own freedom?
I think once you've made Mickey and Minnie people, then the people need a pet. And so the question is, what is the pet going to be, right? Mm. And
can't be humans. That's bizarre.
I mean, it can't be a mouse because they're mice. So what? You can't go smaller, really. And we're probably thinking too hard. But no, I mean, you're right. What happens when Goofy's in the room with Pluto? Is Pluto kind of looking at Goofy and saying, you know,
Goofy doesn't have do they recognize each other even as dogs? Like, you wonder how dogs recognize. They're so different, like a little Chihuahua and a Great Pyrenees.
But they do.
They do, yeah.
The other possibility is evolution. My daughter, she put out that maybe this is a post-apocalyptic world, this Mickey Mouse world, and that, you know, some animals evolved and other animals did not. Goofy is the evolved version of the dog, basically, in this world.
Hmm.
So is it evolution or is it oppression? That's the thing. And the other, we need to talk about the semiotics of the pants, too, right? Like, what does it mean
for a dog? Semiotics of the pants.
Yeah, like the whole, right? And then an issue, like, which pets wear pants and which ones don't? Are the ones that don't, are they naked or are they just animals? Or
a Scooby-Doo is another one.
Yeah.
So in that one, everyone's perfectly cool with a dog that kind of sort of talks.
But he doesn't wear clothes, right?
He does not wear clothes unless he's on all fours, unless he's pretending to be
something. Oh, right, the disguise.
The disguise, yeah. In which case he can be upright awkwardly with clothing on and kind of sort of talking.
Don't get
so
traction.
Who are you in the Scooby-Doo universe, Rick? Who's
I'm an old Mr. Parker, they call it. The crime.
No, Shaggy. Totally Shaggy.
Not Shaggy at all. Look
not
at
anymore.
Him. Where's the Shag?
There's another issue with cartoons that I think we need to address.
Okay.
And that is, you know, the attraction between humans and cartoons. And I will confess that when I was a kid, I had a crush on a couple cartoon characters. Have you guys ever had that? Were there any that you thought were?
What was the cartoon character?
Winnie the Good Witch. When I was a little kid, I thought she was hot. I don't think I had the concept of hot. But I kind of liked her. But
I don't even remember her. What was she? What
she
cartoon?
Was Casper the Friendly Ghost. Oh. And then there was like the female dog and Top Dog. And then there's a moment in Wayne's World where Garth asks Wayne if he was ever attracted to Bugs Bunny when he was a female bunny. And Wayne goes, no. And Garth goes, just checking.
I think there's another issue. You never see cross-species dating in any of these.
Really?
All right. Think about it.
Let me think.
That's totally uncool. You don't have Minnie Mouse going out with Donald Duck, not even Scrooge McDuck.
There is a skunk who likes a dog.
Oh, Pepe Le Pew.
Pepe Le Pew.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Pepe Le Pew loves the cat.
But it's the futility of it. That's the joke.
That is the joke.
It can never happen.
Hmm. So think about that for a second.
He's the amorous French skunk, too, right?
This Pepe Le Pew.
Probably smoking cigarettes and reading The Stranger, you know, and all that.
So it's fine to have dogs that talk and wear clothes, but interspecies romance would just be too far.
We'll have to check on that. Yeah,
and I mean, definitely. I mean, humans and pets, I could see that being weird. But you know, why not a skunk and a cat? Come on, you're letting them talk. Why can't they like each other? And speaking of talking, this is the serious part for me. At some point, these animators created a world, and they had to say, "We want these animals to be more human. What do we give them? Why is Goofy human but Pluto not? Well, Goofy stands upright." And he talks, you know, and my son, for example, who's 11, Max, he doesn't talk. So is that the defining aspect of humanity, is the ability to communicate with each other? There's not an easy answer to that. But that's, you know, when you're starting in science fiction or in fantasy, that kind of, you know, says, OK, well, you're creating a world from scratch and you're thinking what makes us human.
What do you think about the new autistic character on Sesame Street?
Julia. I think she's awesome. They've done a really good job. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I read a piece about all the work and research and just, you know, thought that went into creating that character. And, you know, the autism community, it seems like, has welcomed her.
She's just another person. She has these quirks. You know, she'll jump up and down a lot. And kids, my son did this. Kids who have autism, because of their sensory issues, they'll often do weird things with their bodies, like flap their arms or jump a lot. And they incorporate that into Julia, or they'll have strange fixations. And they incorporate that too. But what they show is the other characters, Abby Cadabby, the typical kid who comes along to play with Julia, just, you know, she just riffs off of it. She's like, okay, let's play a game, you know, Simon Says. and whatever the autistic character Julia does, then Abby does.
So they show her being accepted versus here's a problem that she has that we're going to solve. They just seamlessly put her in.
Yeah, it's like, oh, okay. She's different. Usually when you're talking with other kids, you know, Max isn't a big deal. Once they understand, like he goes to a playground and the other kids might try to talk to him and he doesn't talk back. And I'll just explain to him, oh, Max doesn't talk. They're cool with it. They just like go right along. It's the adults that get all worked up about it.
So that story, I haven't seen the Sesame Street. That really happened to me. I worked at the Campbell County Public Library in Huntington with Joe Sullivan. It's been the subject of documentaries and things. And we would have...
He's an adult with autism whose mother founded a movement around rethinking autism.
Right.
Because it used to be people thought that autism was caused by a cold parent.
Cold mother, yeah.
All this crap.
Yep. And it was like one of the best experiences of my life. We would play. We'd have all these games. We'd speak this language of our own and have these rituals that we would do every day. I loved it. It was really great. And I still go around saying Joe Sullivanisms, you know, that.
Like what?
He would have random number. Like his favorite license plate was DT5153. He just loved it. He would go around saying that. And I would change the sequence and see if he liked it or not. And sometimes he would reject it. And anyway, we just had a lot of fun. It was great.
Like, is that your Bible verse for the week / word of wisdom? What are you thinking about for this week?
You know, if they really do away with healthcare on a massive scale, a line from a spiritual came to me. God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time.
What does that mean?
It means that I think if you really, the way I think about it, if you really undo the basic safety net for people, you're not going to really contribute to the well-being of society. And it's even going to inconvenience rich people at some point, believe it or not. I think they think that's not true.
And that's The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director and CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. That's Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. And we've also been joined by Lori Lynn, lawyer, conservative columnist. Thank you both for joining me. Appreciate it.
Just like everybody else.